Thank you, everybody, especially Trio today. Thank you so much for bringing this to this point. It's amazing that we get to this point every Sabbath, ready to hear the word, to continue worship. I had a member tell me once that probably he said the one thing, but maybe one of the many things they didn't like about my preaching was how I preach that we have to keep on sinning. I don't think I ever taught that we have to keep on sinning. I don't think that I ever said that. However, I believe we do have to acknowledge that we are sinners. To quote from my favorite book ever written about prayer, Norwegian theologian Holly Allesby settled on the single word that is a summary of the heart attitude that God accepts as prayer. Wouldn't you like to know what the one thing is that God accepts as prayer? I would like to. Wouldn't you like to know that your prayers are accepted by God? One thing: helplessness. Whether it takes the form of words or not means nothing to God. Whether your prayer takes the form of words or not means nothing to God. That only means something to us. Only he who is helpless can truly pray. What a stumbling block. Almost from birth, we aspire to self-reliance. Adults celebrate it as a triumph whenever children learn to do something on their own. And as adults, we like to pay our own way. We live in our own houses. We make our own decisions. We rely on no outside help. We even look down on those who live off what we call welfare or charity. And all the while, we are systematically sealing off the heart attitude most desirable to God and most descriptive of our true state in the universe. Jesus summed it up by looking at all of his disciples and saying, "Apart from me, you can do nothing." Prayer forces me to catch sight of my true state. In Henri Nouwen's words, to pray is to walk in the full light of God and to say simply without holding back, "I am human and you are God." At that moment, conversion occurs, the restoration of the true relationship. A human being is not someone who once in a while makes a mistake, and God is not someone who now and then forgives. No, human beings are sinners, and God is love. A character in one of Henry Adams' novels cries out in frustration, "Why must the church always appeal to my weakness and never to my strength?" Well, I can think of a couple of reasons. In a world that glorifies success, an admission of weakness disarms pride at the same time that it prepares us to receive grace. Meanwhile, the very weakness that drives us to pray becomes an invitation for God to respond with compassion and with power. The Lord upholds all those who fall down and lifts up all who are bowed. In the presence of the great physician, my most appropriate contribution is my wounds. That line's going to stick with you, isn't it? In the presence of the great physician, my most appropriate contribution is my wounds. The constant acknowledgement of who I am and who he is. My dearest friend in ministry has a saying that every time he feels that he is not reliant, every time he feels that he's doing just a little bit better, he remembers the words echoed in his head, "You are God, and I am not." I think this is why I like this series so much. I think this is why I'm enthralled with this series. I didn't think this series would do this to me. I didn't think that it would get under my skin like this, and it really has. For those of you that are visiting, we base this series on one word, one Greek word. It's only used 13 times in the entire Bible. And it's only attributed to Jesus himself. It's attributed to nobody else in the New Testament. It's not attributed to his disciples. It's not attributed in any form or manner to anybody but Jesus. And we summarize that word with just one word: guts. What Jesus had that no one else has is guts. He's got insides. And it's translated as being moved with compassion. And the Bible writers that observed it, Matthew and Mark, who use it the most, who observed it, who see it, who heard it, say that only he is moved like that. And it's a mystery to them. So they use this Greek word that simply means that it comes from within. And you have to remember, they've never seen an MRI. They have never seen a CAT scan. They've never even seen an X-ray. They have no idea what's inside here. All they know is that something inside him moves him with compassion. That's why we call this a gut feeling. It's a mystery to them. And the reason it's a mystery to them is because they've noticed that no one else had it. It's not attributed to anybody else. It's not attributed to them as disciples. They've never even come close. So we move ahead. Last time that Mark and Matthew both said it was the first time that he came ashore and there was a great crowd and they got hungry. We call it the feeding of the 5,000. That was the last time that it was used. The next time that it's used is almost the same situation. We're not quite sure how much later it is, but if you look at the journey that they take, From Galilee over to Tyre and Sidon and back over to Galilee, it probably took at least 2 weeks. So 2 weeks later, it's used again, and it's used again right here. And again, he has compassion on who? On the crowd. He comes ashore and he has compassion for the crowd, for they've been with me now for 3 days and they have nothing to eat. They've been sitting there listening to him for 3 whole days. 3 days and nothing to eat. Matthew put it this way. He says, Jesus called his disciples to him and said, I feel compassion for the people because they've remained with me now for 3 days and have nothing to eat. And I don't want to send them away hungry, for they may faint on the way. We know that he's already done this once, just a couple weeks ago. Almost the exact same scenario. Here it seems they've been there a little longer than before. Before, you get the idea that they've been there all day. And now it's night. These people have been here for 3 days now. The only difference this time is that he tells them, I don't want to send them away. Remember last time, the disciples' idea was to send them away. Send them away so they may go buy something to eat. Did Jesus like that idea? No, he did not. He said, you give them something to eat. This time, he takes the answer out of their mouth. He says, look, if you're going to say it again, I'm telling you right now, I'm not going to send them away. And I don't want them to be sent away. And he tells them why. If we send them away, you know what's going to happen? They're going to get out there and pass out. And I don't want that to happen. And as with before, in between the times that the gospel writer uses that word, moved with compassion, there's been some events that have happened from the last time that he was moved with it, the last time he had it. So I want to go real quick through these events, and I do want to tell you that at least one of them, I might have to step on some toes, so I'm just helping you be ready. Put on your steel-toed boots. Because we're going to have to crawl into some skin. We're going to have to forget that we live in the 21st century, and we're going to try to get in the hearers' hearts. By the way, remember we said that before, the most accurate way to translate or to interpret what's going on is that if we could figure out what they heard, if we could figure out what they were hearing and what it meant to them, that's what I want to do. The first event is that, remember before, he dismissed the crowd, and he sent the disciples out in a boat, right? And he went up the mountain to what? He went up the mountain to pray. We don't know what time it was, but he looks out and he sees, and he begins to walk across the water. And it's really interesting that if you hear Mark tell it, Mark says that he was just going to walk right on by them. But he saw them straining against the oars. Apparently there's a storm that's going on. And so he walks then towards them. He changes direction and walks towards them. And of course they looked and they said, wow, that's Jesus walking on the water. Come on in. They didn't, did they? They were rather frightened, weren't they? They were rather frightened. Matthew tells the story about Peter saying, he wants to walk. Mark doesn't tell that story. He leaves it out. But that's what happened, right? And after the whole thing happened with Peter, They made room, Mark says, and he gets on the boat. He gets on the boat. So that happened. Event number one. Jesus walks on the water. As if feeding 5,000 with just a few loaves and fish wasn't enough, that night he walks on the water towards them, allows one of them to walk on the water towards him, and then saves him, and then gets on the boat. Mark says they were absolutely astounded. Astounded. They should have an idea about who he is now. But they're still asking. When he gets on the boat, they say, "Who is this? Who is this that even the waves listen to him?" Man. The next is that he's swarmed by crowds. When they land, he's now swarmed by crowds. By this time, I remember one commentator saying, he's a rock star now. He can't go anywhere. He's Michael Jordan. He's a rock star. He can go nowhere. I remember hearing a story about Michael Jordan is that pretty soon there was absolutely nowhere he could go that he could not be recognized. You know, for a long time, Michael Jackson and Muhammad Ali were the two most recognized faces in the world. They could go nowhere in the world without being recognized. I'm not so sure that that's a good thing. But Jesus is now, he can't go anywhere. His reputation has preceded him. He can't go anywhere. And it says, wherever he went into villages or cities or farms, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and begged that they might touch even the fringe of his cloak, and all who touched it were healed. There is a little difference about him healing the people this time than before, because the same thing happened before. From the time that he uses it, these events happen by the time that he comes to the shore. And one of the events was that he was healing a bunch of people last time, but it seemed to be more personal. He was touching them. He was talking to them. Jairus' daughter. The woman with the issue of blood on his way to heal Jairus' daughter. This time, though, he's not even touching them. They're just touching his what? They're just touching his cloak. Wow. All they ought to do is touch his cloak. And it brings back the point. And I know I hammered and belabored that point, but Jesus even has compassion on the crowds. Something that you and I don't have. Maybe we can muster up a little compassion with people that we know. Maybe we can muster up just a little bit of mercy with somebody that we love. Maybe we can have a bit of compassion with our children or our grandchildren. Jesus can do it with crowds. He can do it no matter who they are. He sees the faces in the crowds. He doesn't see crowds the way that you and I do. This crowd is just sick and lame, and he's making it easy for them. Just touch it. That's all they got to do. So that's happening. The disciples see that. That's going on. The next one's a little tough. It's a little hard. It's a hard lecture, if you will, to listen to as a Seventh-day Adventist. And I will admit, as a Seventh-day Adventist, it's hard for me to listen to Jesus lecture the Pharisees about this particular thing. But after all this going on, this is what's amazing about the Pharisees, is that he's healing people simply by just touching the cloak, and he's walking across water, and he's feeding thousands of people with just loaves and fish, and the Pharisees have this problem with him. The Pharisees and the scribes are wondering why you don't wash your hands before you eat. That's their problem. I don't know about you, but I think I'd have something a bit more substantive to discuss with him. You think? But it's a hard lecture to listen to. First thing, both Matthew and Mark say is that Jesus quoted Isaiah to them, right back. The very first thing that he quotes to them is from Isaiah, right? He says to them, Isaiah prophesied rightly about you. I think that's what's so tough to listen to, is that he looks him right in the eye and he says, you. This isn't some sort of vague parable where maybe you can pick yourself up in one of the characters. Maybe you can understand one of those. No, he looks him right in the eye and he says, Isaiah said this about you. I'm not so sure I want to be on the other end of this conversation. And I changed my mind real quick about wanting to argue with him about eating with unclean hands. But what did Isaiah say about them? This people honors me with their what? Honors me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. By the way, where is your heart? Is it on the inside or on the outside? Are you getting where I'm coming from? The inside is far from me. You can worship me with your lips. In other words, you can open up the book and you can read the words and you can worship me with your words, with your mouth. But your heart, your insides, you're gutless. You got people here being healed. You got people here being fed. You have God incarnate walking around in flesh. And you want to talk to me about ritual impurity. That's what happens when people holier than thou meet somebody who is thou much holier than them. Your heart is far from me. Your guts. Why are our guts so far from him? Because we don't have them. We're earthly citizens. This is earthies, remember? This is dust insides. We have dusty insides. We're citizens of this kingdom. We're citizens of the world. That's where these bodies belong. One day they will go back to dust. One day he'll give us one with guts. But for right now, we don't got it. The best we can do is open up and try to keep a commandment and then be snooty about it to other people. We wash our hands. So do our disciples. You don't. Why? Why? In vain they do worship me, teaching human precepts as doctrine. The ritual cleansing is not quite a human precept. You do find it in Scripture, don't you? There were many times when you became unclean in ritual impurity where you needed to wash yourself, and then you were usually unclean for a period of time. Most of them, till when? Till sundown. Till sundown. Somebody asked me once, well, what's the worst thing that would ever happen to you, Greg, if you really were unclean, if you eat a piece of bacon? I'd be unclean till sundown. That's it? Really? What's the big deal? Ritual impurity was brought about by God as an object lesson. You understand? God wanted them to know. God wanted them to understand just a little bit. He wanted them to think about their daily life. He gave them things to have them think about it. So there was this idea of what we call ritual impurity. The danger in that, I can't believe he trusted us with it, but the danger in it is that there would be some who would become so good at it that they would make that their practice, and that they would make that their salvation, and that they would make that their works, and they would make that their way of saying that I am not dependent on anybody anymore. And the reason they can do that is that they go and they find people who are more dirty than they are. And that's what they've done with this. Ritual impurity has become ritual rejection. They begin to teach that if you are unclean, if you do unclean things, that makes you an unclean person. And if you're unclean, then I can certainly stand beside you and look real clean, but I'm not allowed to touch you. Now, I wouldn't have a problem with that if they would leave it at that, but then they begin to teach people that that's how God felt about them. Right? Now, the reason that this is so hard for us is because we stay away from unclean foods because they're unclean? No. Because they're what? Because they're unhealthy. So here's the problem is that we run into this, and we begin to think of the health message, and you have to understand that back in the first century, was there a health message? No, there was not. Again, it's a mystery. Germs, bacteria, everything, it's a mystery. You go back to the first century and try to talk to people about germs and bacteria, what are they going to say? You're crazy. You go back to the first century and try to talk to them about what's going on in their inside. You know what they're going to say? You're crazy. So this isn't about the health message. Do you understand? This is why it's so hard. This is why we kick up against this. This isn't about washing your hands to be clean. Is it a good idea to wash your hands before dinner? Yes, it is. But you do know that in the desert, the Talmud says that if you don't have the water, all you have to do is go through the motion. And in Mark, when it says, a little later, Mark will explain, he says, you know, the Pharisees, they took to not just washing hands, but they'll wash pots and cups and pans and everything else. And you know why? The word that he uses for wash is the Greek word baptizo. It's not to wash it to make it clean. It's to baptize it. It's to ritually make it pure, to ritually make it acceptable. This isn't about health. There is no health message for people in the Bible. God says, this is an object, listen. This is what daily sin does to us. Daily sin separates us. Guilt, the guilt that we carry. And what it was designed to do was that when it separated me, when I considered myself unclean till sundown, well, number one, it tried to give me consideration for my wife. I don't want to make her unclean, so I separate myself as the law says. And while I'm separated, I can begin to live with that separation. Otherwise, my heart becomes so hard to my sin that I never go to God with anything anymore. It was supposed to be an object lesson. And it actually was supposed to teach us how sinful we are. But the self-righteous, the church of the day, took it to prove how unclean you are and how clean I am. And ritual impurity becomes ritual rejection. Jesus will give an example. He says, look, if you don't buy this, he says, look, the commandment said, honor your mother and your father, but you'll take Leviticus 2:1 and you'll take whatever you're supposed to give to your mother and your father and you'll offer it to the Lord and tell your mom and dad, look, I don't have anything for you. I already offered it to the Lord. Korban is the Aramaic word of the offering, if you will. And what are they doing now? They're using one commandment to negate the other. And they don't even have compassion. They're not even moved with compassion for their own mother and their own father. Do you understand why Jesus is having this conversation in front of his disciples right now? Because weren't they kind of the same way a couple weeks ago? Remember, they've been sent out and they come back and they've been casting out demons and they've been healing people and they come back and they tell Jesus, we've been casting out demons and we've been healing people. Not one word about the people that they healed. It was all about who? It was all about them. You see why Jesus is having this conversation in front of his disciples right now? You think he's going to convince these Pharisees? No. He's having the conversation for you and me. We get to listen to it. We get to hear it. We get to be moved. Hopefully we get to be moved. And like me, I hope that you then recognize the Pharisee within you when you hear it. He's going to prove it. He's going to prove it. It's not just a lecture. It's a lecture and a debate to the Pharisees, but they're about to go someplace where he's going to prove it to them firsthand. It says, he said, look, from within the human heart, the evil intentions come. Fornication, theft, murder, adultery, avarice, wickedness, deceit, licentiousness, envy, slander, pride, folly. All these things come from within and they defile a person. He says, look, what you take in from the outside cannot defile you. It's what comes from within. It doesn't matter what you eat. It can't make you unclean. Why? Because you're going to eat it and it's going to what? And it's just going to pass through you. He said, what truly makes us unclean is what comes from without. And notice those sins that he listed there. They're all sins that are done against someone else. What truly defiles us is when we have no compassion, no mercy, and we do these things to others, and we do it without thinking about them. Why? Because we're gutless. We don't have it within us. This is what defiles us, he says. You don't become unclean from something on the outside making you unclean. So note, if you want to know what makes us truly defiled, is that when we treat people like the Pharisees have treated people, the way his disciples are treating people, with no compassion, without being moved, and committing these and many, many more things, that's what truly defiles us. And the second is, the reason why is because it comes from the heart. He says, I don't have to examine your heart. All I have to do is watch and see how you treat other people. And that's how he knows whether or not we're defiled. Not whether or not we touched or ate anything unclean, but how we treat others. So like I said, it's not just a lecture. It's not just something to think about, although I would think that this would be earth-shattering for its day. Hard for us to listen to again because we're thinking of the health message, but I'd like you to just remove the health message from this completely. You know, and I wish we hadn't used the word unclean in our doctrinal statement about the health message. I wish we'd just used the word unhealthy. We can get the menu from Leviticus, but we don't get the theology from Leviticus. You understand? Don't tell people that you eat the way you do because you don't want to be unclean. Tell them that you don't want to be unhealthy because we don't believe in ritual purity and impurity anymore. Amen? Okay. Anyway, the lecture is going to give way to proof because from there he says he's going to go to the region of what? The region of Tyre, and he entered a house and did not want anyone to know he was there. I love that little thing that Mark puts in. Matthew leaves it out, but Mark puts it in. He goes, he tried to hide in a house. He tried to hide in a house, yet he could not escape notice. And look who shows up. A woman finds him there, whose little daughter had an unclean spirit, immediately heard about him, and she came and bowed at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile of Syrophoenician origin. She begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. Syrophoenician origin, if you look on the coast, the Mediterranean coast, you have Sidon, you have Tyre, and all of that is the area known as Syrophoenicia. It was settled by the Syrians and the Phoenicians. Who is the original Syrophoenician woman? There are only three Syrophoenician women that I know of that are mentioned prominently in the Bible. You know who the original is? Jezebel. Jezebel was a Syrophoenician woman. Her father was the king of Sidon. She's the original Syrophoenician woman. She figures pretty prominently, doesn't she, in a particular Bible story. Thing about Tyre and Sidon, and I have it here in my notes, and I wouldn't be able to get it across to you, but it's this woman here, it's not just that she's a pagan, she's the paganist of pagans. Tyre and Sidon have some of the most horrible, horrible fertility cult religions. It's absolutely terrible. Child sacrifice happening right and left. They sacrifice babies, and they put them in the mortar of their temples. They use them for mortar. It's horrible. It's absolutely horrible. This woman is the paganist of pagans. And of course, Jezebel proves that. In fact, she tries to kill every prophet in Israel. Why? Because they're not prophets of who? They're not prophets of Baal and Ashtoreth. These horrible, horrible fertility gods and goddesses that ask for our blood sacrifice. She's the original. The next one, which is funny, Elijah's on the run. Why? Because Jezebel wants to what? Wants to kill him. There's a bunch of places that God could have sent him, but guess where he sends him? He sends him to the house of a widow of Zarephath. Guess where Zarephath is? Syrophoenicia, second Syrophoenician woman. I think God has a great sense of humor. He's got one Syrophoenician queen trying to kill him. He sends him to the house of a Syrophoenician widow. And of course, the Syrophoenician widow, who has nothing, is completely dependent, actually puts up the man of God, if you will. And you know, it's a beautiful story. I'm not saying that there was anything romantic involved, but I think Elijah truly fell in love with that family. Because after he helped them, you know how he pleads with God when her son dies? Man. Then the next time you see a Syrophoenician woman, it's right here. It's right here. So she's got this going against her, if you will. She's there. She's crying out. She begs him to cast the demon out of her daughter. You know what the disciples are thinking, don't you? Disciples are wanting out of here. It's the same when he's sitting there talking to the Samaritan woman. Get this woman out of here. So her daughter's possessed. She deserves to be possessed. She probably sacrificed 3 children before she had this daughter. They're pagans, Lord. They deserve whatever is coming to them. Tyre and Sidon is a cesspool. But they tried to be a little bit nice, and they put it this way. I didn't even have it. I don't have it here. But in Matthew 15:23, it says that he did not answer her a word after she begs him. Okay, he did not answer her a word, and his disciples came and implored him, saying, "Send her away, for she keeps shouting after us." If you've got a study Bible, you'll notice a footnote after shouting. Again, it's one of those things that English doesn't get across to us. Okay, it's the Greek word kradzio, and it's almost onomatopoetic. Kradzio. It's a screech, if you will. The way that these proper dictionaries put it, it says, the cry of the raven, hence universally to cry out, to cry aloud, to vociferate, particularly of an inarticulate cry. In other words, it's hard on the what? It's hard on the ears. One says to shout or to cry out with the impossible implication of the unpleasant nature of the sound. The unpleasant nature of the sound. Lord, if you can't get her to shut up, then send her away, for she's shouting at us. Ugh! Is there any more unpleasant sound than the braying of a donkey? No. When the writers were translating the Old Testament, the Hebrew scriptures, into Greek, they used this word for the braying of a donkey in Job and in Psalm 27. That's what they hear. And do you think that her history has something to do with that? They know she's from Syrophoenicia. Because why? Because they're there. I think the disciples are uncomfortable even being there. But they're there, and this woman comes up. Do you think that her history, knowing who she is, this history of Jezebel and everybody going all the way back, we know who this pagan is. Do you think that that has something to do with what they're hearing? Of course, Jesus doesn't hear it, does he? He doesn't hear it the same way. Why? Because he's got guts. He's got compassion. He doesn't hear this screechy raven croak, braying of a donkey. What he hears is a crying child, wherever that child is. A child possessed by a demon and living in a hell that you and I can't even imagine. He plays along. Doesn't answer. His disciples come, urged her, saying, "Send her away." She's shouting after us, and said to her, "Let the children be fed first, for it's not fair to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs." Did Jesus call her a dog? He did, didn't he? Do you think he feels that way about her? Why'd he say it, y'all? You're with me today, aren't you? Why'd he say it? He wanted the disciples to hear it. He wanted the disciples to hear how heartless it sounds. He wanted the disciples to recognize how heartless they're being right now. Even though he's doing what they want him to do, get rid of her. Does he? Does this send her packing? No. What'd she say? But sir, even the dogs under the table eat the what? Eat the children's crumbs. There's something about this master. She doesn't care. She doesn't care that he thinks she's a dog. She doesn't care that they think she's a pagan. She knows her history. She knows where she's at. You know what's motivating her, what's moving her, is that she has guts for her daughter. It's her daughter that's moving her. I don't care what you think, but there's something about you, Master. There's something about you. You're not like other rabbis. You'll do what I ask because I think you feel just a little bit for my daughter the way I do. And then Mark actually adds, for saying that, he said, for saying that, he said, go. The demon has left your daughter. And she went home and she found the child laying on the bed and the demon what? And the demon gone. What did the disciples just see? They saw a living example of that lecture he just gave to the Pharisees. He went out here and he proved it. Pagan, does it matter to Jesus? No. Pagan crowd, Jewish crowd, believing crowd, hungry crowd, angry crowd, violent crowd, he doesn't care. I have compassion for them. Which brings us to the seashore again. What do you think they've learned in 2 weeks? Maybe three. You think they've learned anything? You think they've gotten better? You think that they are now towering giants and examples of faith? You think that they are now towering examples of compassion? See, because 2 weeks later, not much has changed. The only thing that's changed is the numbers. Last week or last month, it was 5,000. This time, it's 4,000. Last month, it was 5 loaves and 2 fish. Now, it's 7 loaves and a few fish. And he says, and the only thing he does different is, look, if you're going to come up with the idea again of sending them away, I'm telling you right now, I don't want to send them away. So he's even kind of moving them along a little bit, isn't he? Just moving them along a little bit. The teaching of the impurity, the healings, the Syrophoenician woman. And after that, there was the deaf and the mute people that were brought to him. And he made spit and he put his fingers in their ears and they began to speak. And everybody's praising God and everything else. How will they act now when they're faced with this same situation that they were 2 weeks ago? I have compassion for the crowd because they've been with me now for 3 days and they have nothing to eat. They're being cued. And what do they say? How can one feed these people with bread here in the desert? It's what I would have done as their rabbi. It's what I would have done. You know, the problem is that I feel pretty good about myself right now. And the thing is that I would have asked the same question. See, I don't know if you've gotten this from me by now, but I put this much stock in human nature. We don't become good by hanging around good. We don't become good by observing good. We don't become compassionate and merciful by observing it. As a matter of fact, when we observe somebody more compassionate and more merciful, you know what my human nature does? It makes me resent them because they're better than me. My guilt begins to get to me. And then I begin to resent them. And then I begin to notice little things like Grady is more compassionate than me, but he doesn't wash his hands before he eats. So before we begin to puff ourselves up and begin to pat ourselves on the back, we must understand that those disciples are us. Do they represent you? Yeah. Their lack of faith at this point in time may be astounding. But it's not their lack of faith. And you have to remember something that happened before they got in the boat before this time. The way Mark put it, he says, when they got in the boat, and the wind ceased. This was after Peter walked on the water and everything else, and now they get back in the boat. Mark says this, he says, they were utterly astounded, and they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. It's not lack of faith, it's lack of compassion. And Jesus wants us to recognize that today. We don't have it. We don't have it. If we can muster up just a little bit of compassion, we could muster up a mustard seed of faith. But what happens is that we try to develop faith without compassion, and then we end up like the Pharisees. I'm more faithful than you are. And I can prove it by this outward appearance that I have, this outward assent that I have to the letter of the law. Their hearts are hardened. They have no faith because they have no compassion on the people that Jesus has compassion on. And there just comes a time when we have to understand that that's who we are. By the way, notice how the man with guts treats them. Did he do what I just did? Did he call him out in front of the crowd? That's what I would have done. Dude, 3 weeks ago, you had your opportunity. This just happened 3 weeks ago. I'd call him out in front of the crowd. I would embarrass the snot out of them. But what did he do? I don't think he even shook his head. He looked at him. He smiled. He said, have everybody sit down. Bring me the few loaves and the few fish. And he does it all again. And he certainly isn't going to withhold his compassion on the people because his disciples are compassionless. So that's another thing I would have done. All right, fine. They're going to starve. They're going to try to go home and they're going to pass out. And guess what? 12, it's all on you. I'm good. That's how heartless I am. I'd let people starve to prove a point. It's a righteous point. And that's what Jesus said. This religion, it's the problem with religion, is that it could look good on the outside. It could look righteous, and yet inside we're gutless. We don't have it. We have earthy insides, and we got to depend on Him. That word that Mark uses, a hardened heart, it's only used 5 times. And there's quite a few times it's in Romans, it's in Mark 8:17. By the way, in less than three days, they're going to hear a lecture, another lecture to the Pharisees. They're going to be in a boat. Jesus is going to look at them and say, he's going to say, beware of the yeast of the Pharisees. And they're going to say, I think he's mad at us because we didn't bring any bread. No what? They got 7 basketfuls sitting in the boat, and he's mad because they didn't bring bread. Again, how much did they learn? It's not about learning. It's about not having compassion. It's about not being moved. We're just not. But there's one place where it says that it's hard, and in 2 Corinthians 3:14, it's got a big context to it, but I won't. The verse just says, but their minds were hardened, speaking of Israel. For until this very day, at the reading of the Old Covenant, the same veil remains unlifted because it is only removed in Christ. That veil, my lack, my hard heart, my earthy insides are only removed by Christ because He has it and I don't. And any time, any move, any sense of holiness that I'm moving away from that, I will become less dependent on Him and more dependent on me. I will never have the compassion that He does. He has the guts. He has the inside. I'm going to be dependent on Him for my life for how long? Forever. I'm trusting that those insides that He has will not go away. Ever. Because once they do, you and I are finished. I won't have Him in the kingdom either. Now, I'm not saying I'm going to still be fallen in the kingdom. We're not going to be fallen in the kingdom because we're going to be given perfect bodies. Maybe we'll have some of those insides, but there's still a gap. There's still a gap where we will stand around the throne and be worshiping and be singing, you are God and I am not. Holy, holy, holy. Only you are worthy. we're not going to be singing how good we've become. Amen? We talk about the commandments. We talk about the, we did it in the covenant series, you know. We looked at the commandment, the commandments themselves, the Ten Commandments. You know, I wish sometimes that we would quote people the seventh-day Sabbath commandment, not from Exodus, but from Deuteronomy. Because in Deuteronomy 5:15, it says, "Remember that you were a slave in the land of Egypt, and the Lord brought you out with a mighty hand and an outstretched arm. Therefore, the Lord your God commanded you to keep the Sabbath day." What's the reason for keeping the Sabbath? It's so I can worship on the right day and everyone else can be wrong? No, it's because I'm supposed to remember that I was once a slave in Egypt, but the Lord delivered me with a mighty hand and a strong arm. Therefore, I remember the Sabbath day. He was needing water, he was needing food, and it was getting towards the end of the week, and the sun was beginning to go down, and he came up upon this old man's farm. And the old man was an acre away, but he could see him, and the old man had seen it before because he's got that farm that's right on that road, you know, and that road is a main road, so the old man had seen it before. So the old man comes walking over, and he says, "Friend," he says, "can I help you?" And he says, "Yeah, if you can just give me a few things, I'll be on my way." And the old man looks at the sun, and he goes, "You know what? You don't want to be caught out there at night. You don't want to be caught out there at night." He said, "I could give you a few things, but you're going to be out there at night. You don't want to be out there. Come and join my wife and me. My wife prepares a wonderful Sabbath meal, so come on in and spend it with me. And then maybe later you can be on your way." And the old man says, "That's nice. That's awfully nice of you. Why would you do that?" And the old man looked at him, "Because I was a slave in Egypt, and the Lord delivered me with a mighty arm and a strong hand. Therefore, I remember the Sabbath day." So he brings them in, and they do. They have that wonderful meal, and he says, "You know what?" He's not so sure about this hospitality because nobody's ever treated in this way before. He's an alien. He's a sojourner. He doesn't belong. He doesn't belong anywhere where he's at. And this couple keeps, you know, pouring this hospitality on him. He's not sure. He trusts it, and he says, "You know, I'm full now, and if you could give me just a little water, I'll be on my way, and I won't bother you anymore." He says, No, stay. We have a room for you. We have straw for your donkey. We have a room for you. Just stay with us tonight." And he says, but why? Why would you have me here?" And this time the woman says, "Because we were once slaves in Egypt, and the Lord delivered us with a strong arm and with a mighty hand. Therefore, we remember the Sabbath day." And of course, they get up the next morning, and they have a wonderful Sabbath devotion, and they have a great meal. And after every meal, he tries to push himself away. "You know, I don't want to overstay my welcome." And every time that he tries to do that, either the old man or the old woman just look at him and say, no, "You got to stay. You have to stay. Stay at least until the sun goes down. You need to stay with us." And he goes, "But I don't understand. Why would you want me to stay?" And they both then together say, "Because we were once slaves in Egypt, and the Lord delivered us with a mighty arm and a strong hand. Therefore, we remember the Sabbath day." You know, and they got him to stay all day. They got him to stay one more night. And in the morning, they gave him breakfast. And he looked over in the corner, and his backpack was filled with water and with food and everything. And they gave him, you know, gave him food. And they said, "You're welcome to stay longer, but if you got to go, we do understand." And he goes, "Man. You know, his belly's full," and he looks at him, and he's got just a little bit of a tear in his eye. You know, he's going to miss them. He really is. And he goes over, and he puts his backpack on, and he goes, "Really, I'm so overwhelmed." He says, "I don't understand why you would do this." And the old man opens his mouth, and before he can, the stranger holds up his hand, and he goes, "I know why. Because you were once slaves in Egypt, and the Lord delivered you with a mighty arm and a strong hand. Therefore, that's why you remember the Sabbath day." I rely on him because I got nothing in here of my own. We're here. We try to be better. We try to be merciful. And we try and we try, and please continue to try. But don't ever think that we're ever going to be moved the way he is moved. And we don't have to, because he is. We don't have to, because he is. Does he know that I've got nothing inside? Does he know that you've got nothing inside? And yet he calls you and me rocks to tell people that we were once slaves in Egypt. But the Lord delivered us with a mighty hand and with a strong arm. Therefore, we worship him. Let's pray. Father, I want to thank you so much for bringing us together today. I want to thank you for the opportunity to study your word, the opportunity to see what you have, and to ask you just for a bit. We thank you that you forgive us. We thank you that you accept us. We thank you that you commission us. And we thank you and we praise you that you trust us, jars of clay, insides of nothing, that you would trust us with your gospel. Help everybody here, Lord. Help everybody here remember who they are and to touch someone else with your love and your grace this week. We ask for safety. We ask to be kept from harm and temptation. And we ask that we be drawn closer to you this week, for we have nowhere else to go. We praise you and we thank you. In Jesus' name.